I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. So I don't remember what age I was exactly, but I remember this birthday party I had when I was, you know, 5 or 6 or so. You know, when I was a kid, we didn't really have play dates or invite friends from my school over to our house very much, so it was a big deal for me to do that. And I remember going outside to the yard to play with them, and my parents setting up a table on the deck for a proper meal. They had never heard of just ordering a pizza and calling it a day. And like how much fun it was. And I also remember how nervous I got when it was time to bring the food out. Like, were all these kids going to be weirded out by Chinese food? And actually, now that I'm thinking about it, it's sort of funny because I say I remember playing and having a good time, but really what I remember was the feeling that I was having a good time and that I didn't want that feeling to turn weird when the food came out. That's the thing I really remember. That nervousness about our food and how my friends who weren't Chinese would react to it. Well, it turns out they liked it. My grandmother mercifully decided not to steam the whole fish, you know, with the eyeballs and the head and everything, and instead just made a massive pan of fried rice, and it turns out everyone likes fried rice, so disaster averted. But right around that time, in 1982, there was a new TV show called Yan Can Cook that started broadcasting over American airwaves. Martin Yan was 33 years old, an immigrant from Hong Kong, where my parents are from, and was teaching Americans how to cook Chinese food with a mix of goofy jokes and slapstick and feats with a cleaver his audience had never seen, including his very famous demo on how to debone a chicken in 18 seconds. Martin Yan was one of the very few, I think maybe only, Asian television hosts with a national audience for years, and it is absolutely impossible to say how many people he's introduced to Chinese and Asian cooking over the last 4 decades. He's written dozens of cookbooks, he's opened restaurants, and now actually travels back to China as an ambassador for American foods. But man, you know, I bring it back to being a kid and watching Yan Can Cook and just being amazed that here was this guy showing a room full of white people how to cook the stuff that I was eating at home and how he had everyone in the audience ooing and eyeing over it. Almost 40 years later, he's still teaching people about the food he loves. And I'm so happy to get to spend the hour with him here today. Chef Martin, it is such an honor to talk with you today. How are you?
I am fine. I'm busier than ever during the pandemic, surprisingly.
I can't believe that you could be busier than you've already been. You know, you've had TV shows, you've had restaurants, you know, you're hosting your own shows on YouTube right now. But I want to start with you to see if we can go back all the way to the beginning. Can you tell us what you remember about growing up in Guangzhou? Like, do you remember what you ate? What was that like?
Well, I was born and raised in Guangzhou, China. When I was growing up, Guangzhou is only about 1.6 million people. And when I was growing up, actually, it's the most difficult, the most challenging, and the most turbulent time in modern Chinese history, because after the Mao's 3-5 year plan, everything you know, a lot of people really starving and famine and all kind of stuff. So nothing to eat, everything is rationed, and food is very scarce. And just give you an example, we only have about maybe 18 pounds of rice a month, 18 to 20 pounds, and 4 ounces of oil. That means 1/4 cup of oil a month. And then 2 pounds, 2.5 pounds of meat. Meat normally referred to pork. There's no beef, there's no chicken. So in 1 month, each one of us can only survive on a few ounces of oil, just maybe about 8 tablespoons of oil for the whole month.
Yeah.
So it's very, very difficult. And a lot of people have problems because there's not enough nutrients. So then my mom, being a capitalist, because we have a little store, because we have a grocery store, and my father had a restaurant, so we are basically considered to be capitalists. So capitalists, you got to have to go to meetings, brainwash meeting. You got to, every night.
What they call re-education.
Yeah, re-education. basically, to change your from capitalist ideal to communist ideal. And she never really come home until maybe 7. So I used to help to go down to the wet market about 2 blocks away and pick up some of the vegetable. And then I come back and I help even when I was about 8 or 9 years old. So I was helping everybody, helping my mom to wash the vegetable, pick up the vegetable in the market. So we know all the vegetable vendor in the wet markets. Every time I show up, they will give me some leftover because when you go over there and buy in about after school, I go to the wet market. They call it wet market because the floor is really wet. That's why they refer to it as a wet market because they don't have refrigeration.
That's not really why they call it that, is it?
The reason is because they don't have refrigeration. So they would spray the produce and the vegetable throughout the day. So the floor, you go to the wet market in Asia, they're always wet because they spray. Yeah. Just like you go to a supermarket, they have mist to mist the produce. And they do that by spraying all over. So that's why the floor is always, always wet. But anyway.
Wait, is that really why it's called a wet market?
Yeah. Another thing is they sell seafoods, live seafoods. And then they have the little tank all over the floor. And even buckets all over the floor. So and the fish splash all over the place. So you go to wet market in Asia, Singapore, Malaysia, Philippines, anywhere in China, Hong Kong, the floor is always wet.
It's just I didn't know it was so literal.
Yeah,
I just thought they call it that just because it was a name. Yeah,
literally, it's really, really wet. So basically, I help my mom to cook a little bit and get everything ready, prep. So even when I was really young, I was exposed to a lot of these things, identifying vegetable, what is in season, and when I can pick up spinach and cauliflower. I never was exposed to broccoli, asparagus, and avocado, and all of those things. So everything is about gai lan, choy sum, and all the traditional vegetables.
Yeah, of southern China, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's how you started cooking. You started cooking in the home. But then you went into professional culinary training.
Yeah.
Tell us how that started.
Then shortly after that, my father passed away. And then I stayed a few more years in China. And then one day, my mom basically realized, we got to get you out. So he actually encouraged me to left China and went to Hong Kong. So I went to Hong Kong by myself, and I have a little rattan carry-on with a couple of socks and my shorts and a little underwear, and I just took a little boat on the Pearl River, take a little steamboat to Macau. From Macau, I take another boat, a ferry from Macau to Hong Kong. In fact, I still remember when I was so small and so little kid, and I carried $5 in my pocket, $5 in my pocket. When I was going out the ferry and somebody squeezed me, I almost fell down to the water. And and then I have no relatives. I have no relatives, direct relatives in Hong Kong. But I have my father's village buddy operating a restaurant, a very popular restaurant in Hong Kong. So I actually marched right into his restaurant and helped out in the restaurant after high school, because I was attending high school in Hong Kong. So I actually...
Cool. So how old were you during this?
I was about 13, 14 years old. Between 13 to 13 and a half, I left China.
Okay. So and at 13, you left
Guangzhou
and took yourself to Hong Kong by yourself.
I left Guangzhou and go to... Because my father used to live and work in Portland, Oregon. And then, in those days, there's a lot of discrimination, particularly towards the Asian and Chinese. So most of the Chinese have no choice but went back to China. And that's why my father opened a restaurant and opened a grocery store for my mother. So when I was growing up, I have a lot of exposure in Chinese seasoning and what is good, what tastes good, what smells good. even when I was growing up in China.
Hmm. Well, I had no idea your father had spent time in the U.S.
Yeah.
Okay, so sorry, you're in Hong Kong. You walked into your father's friend's restaurant and said, here, I'll help out.
Yeah.
And tell us about how you learned to cook professionally.
You know that traditionally, among the Chinese, particularly from southern China, if you are village buddies, you know, you came from the village and you call all the people older than you, you call them uncle and aunt. So they take you in. They took me in because my father and my little distant uncle from the village, they grew up together when they were little kid. So that's the reason why they take me in. And then because my mother called this village uncle. He said, hey, you got to help my little baby. So take me in. After school, I actually help out and work in the kitchen. I bone the chicken, I fillet the fish, and I wash the bean sprout, and I pluck the vegetable. So this is how I was basically not truly an apprentice. I just kitchen help because I was too young and too short to try to get close to the wok station.
But then how did your skills grow? I know, old school Chinese restaurant chef training is very hard.
Yeah. Basically, it's apprentice. You work under a chef. But when I was so small in the first few years, I can only work and help out to wash things, to wash vegetable, to cut up something, and I help to bone the chicken. So that's why now I can bone a chicken in 18 seconds.
Yeah, I've seen the demo. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. So basically, you know, you just have to work in different station. Whenever they need help in different station, like carry the stuff, making the sauce. So I get a chance to really learn to understand a lot of things, even when I was about 14, 15, 16, throughout the kitchen. From my high school year, I help out after school, in the summer, and on the weekend. So I spent a lot of time in the kitchen, in a professional kitchen. Very rough, very hot, very humid.
Yeah.
The weather in Asia is so hot and humid. No air conditioning. So it's a very, very tough. Working in the kitchen is very, very tough in China.
Yeah, for sure. And at that point, did you think, oh, yeah, I want to keep doing this. I want to learn. I want to be a great chef. How did you get from that 14, 15-year-old to, you know, having the skills to be a chef?
Well, first of all, I tell you the very truth. That's for survival. I really don't have any choice. Okay? It's unlike the young people here in America, you know, their parents say, you know, have a dream, plan your future. You know, you want to be a doctor, work hard. You want to be an engineer. But over there in China, and also during that time, Hong Kong is pretty, it's still not very well developed. And it's a lot of hardship. And it's, economically, it's really in bad shape during that period of time in the 60s and the early 70s. A lot of problem. And the living standard is very low. And a lot of people are actually unemployed because there's not much job. And I just have to survive because I have nowhere to go. So actually, I slept by putting a board on top of the booth and sleep at night. There's no other place. Everybody actually, if you work in a restaurant, you sleep in the restaurant. You work in a factory, you sleep in a factory. There's no apartment, there's no accommodation provided by anybody. So all the service staff and the chef working there, if they marry, they go back home. All of us, single, we stay in the restaurant.
Wow.
Very tough. So and then I really don't get into this because I love it and I enjoy it. It's just a man, basically a survivor.
Yeah.
Besides, I have no direction. My father passed away. My mother never went to school, and so I didn't get any kind of inspiration or direction from my parent and my relatives. So I just have to learn to survive as a young kid.
That's Martin Yan, the star of Yan Can Cook. We'll be back with more with him in just a minute. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're spending this episode with the iconic Martin Yam, the groundbreaking star of Yan Can Cook. We've talked with him about how he moved to Hong Kong when he was just barely a teenager and worked in a restaurant to survive. But how did he get from there to hosting his own show on television? Let's get back to him. And then you moved to Canada, to Calgary.
So
how did you do that, and how did you get started in TV?
So what happened is, during that time, I tried to learn English. So I went to a church and talked to the little kids so I can pick up some English. And then the church leader in a Baptist church, when I've graduated from high school, she actually sponsored me to get a visa to come to North America. Originally, I have a choice to come to America first. And then later on, I find out that if I go to Calgary, Alberta, I don't have to pay for any tuition fee. So end up going to a college in Calgary, Alberta.
Yeah.
And then, unfortunately, that particular year is the coldest year in 40 years. The coldest year in 40 years, minus 40 degrees. If you live in Hong Kong and all of a sudden go to a place that minus 40, you just couldn't take it. So after 3 months, I just find it, this is ridiculous. So then I heard that one of my friend's sister and brother also came to school and went to UC Davis in California, right next to Sacramento. So I took a little Greyhound bus and come down and visit them. And I found, wow, you know, so many bikes in Davis, because Davis is a huge campus, 4,000 acres, bikes all over the place. And I look at the bikes and I feel so much at home, because when I was growing up in China, they don't have car, they don't have anything. Bikes all over. Everybody have a bike.
It was the bicycles? The bicycles sold you on America?
Right. So I look at, wow, you know, this looks like my hometown, China, Guangzhou. So I never went back to Calgary. And then I didn't even pick up my luggage. I asked them to just throw them away. So I attended the UC Davis and get my a bachelor degree and master's degree in food science. And through that period, I actually have another life experience, life journey. I start teaching cooking class. It's a very interesting story that how I get the opportunity to teach cooking class.
Yeah, tell us, please.
Well, what happened is, when I came down, being a foreign student, I have to pay about 3 to 4 times as much as...
Intuition.
Right, intuition. So what I do is, one day, and we have 5 of my friends and myself, 6 of us, get a 2-bedroom apartment. We don't have beds. We just have a little sleeping bag. So 3 of us stay in one room. Mm-hmm. We take turn to cook. And then I like to cook. And these 5 guys doesn't know how to cook, so I end up doing most of the cooking, and they do the shopping, the washing and cleaning, and I do the cooking. And then while we're eating, we used to watch Graham Kerr, Galloping Gourmet, and also Julia Child, French Chef. And I was joking to my my roommate. I said, gee, they are so, not only very, very educational, they show you, they teach you how much fun it is, but they're also having fun.
Yeah.
They're so entertaining. They're having so much fun on television. And I joked, I said, well, maybe hopefully one day I'll be on television. then I heard that Madame Wu in Los Angeles is teaching cooking class at UCLA.
Oh, I'm sorry, who's Madame Wu?
Madame Wu is actually a proprietor, a chef proprietor of a very famous Chinese restaurant, also named Madame Wu.
Okay.
And she actually opened the restaurant and she taught cooking class at UCLA.
Oh, okay.
But she taught in her own restaurant.
Oh, right on.
So I took another Greyhound and I went down to visit her and asked for her advice and said, hey, I'd like to teach too. Because I heard that they're paying about $18 an hour. And those days, the average wage is 60 cents, 65 cents an hour. So I figure out, if I can teach cooking class, I'll be able to make enough money to go to college, to stay at UC Davis. So when I asked for advice, and she said, you know, this is how I did, and I work with the extension, the university extension. So I came back, and I... talked to the extension director of extension and said, I really want to teach. And they asked me, are you a master chef? And I said, no. Are you a head chef? How long have you been working in a restaurant? I said, I've worked in a restaurant for several years. But are you a head chef? I said, no. I'm just a cook. So he said, no, you know, university extension is a very, very much teaching a special skill or special subject matter by experts, by professors or the local experts in the field, like accounting or whatever. And since you don't really have a teaching certificate, you don't have anything, how can you be accepted in our program and teach? And I said, look, I love to teach. I love to cook. And you got to give me a chance. But, you know, after a couple of conversations, is that, look, you know, you're not qualified. You can't, you know, we can't give it to give you the opportunity. But I keep bugging him for a couple of days. And he didn't want to see me. And I wait for him in the parking garage at the back door. Finally, he got so frustrated, he said, okay, I'll give you a chance. I'll put an ad in a little small ad in the local newspaper. And if we can get more than 15 people, I'll give you a chance. If you don't get 15 people, don't ever come back to see me in the office. I just, you know, just too much. And it was really mad, actually, because during that time, I was actually working in some of the restaurants. So I talked to all my friends, all the friends that I know, all my professors. You got to help me out. You got to sign up for this class. And otherwise, I can't stay at UC Davis. So when the ad came out, within a few days, there are actually 43 people signed up.
So the hustle. Wow.
So, yeah, 43. And I go back and say, look, you know, everybody loves Chinese food. Because you know what? That's timing. That's perfect. Because that's the time that a couple of years after Nixon
went to China.
Kissinger went to China. And people just started to be curious about things Chinese. Mm-hmm. And the Chinese restaurant, there's only one Chinese restaurant you see at Davis. So I get to know the guy, and sometimes I go inside and help them out a little bit. And I start teaching during my undergrad and also graduate school, and make enough money to actually go through college. Because I was making $18 an hour, and sometimes I would teach two classes a week at the high. So, and then at the end of the 6 week, the classes last for 6 weeks. At the end of 6 week, I would take the whole class to Chinatown, to tour Chinatown to have dim sum and everything. And I would buy a whole bunch of stuff. And when I come back, I'll sell it to the students. This is how I make some extra money. I'll buy the wok. I buy the seasoning from Chinatown, because those days, supermarket doesn't have any of those. The supermarket doesn't carry any Chinese items except maybe bean sprout and spring roll and bok choy at the most, and nothing else. And at the most, soy sauce. Now you go to any supermarket, the entire aisle is Chinese item, entire aisle is Southeast Asian, entire aisle is Japanese and Korean item. So it's amazing. It's total transformation nowadays.
Yeah. And I would definitely want to get to what people knew about Chinese food when you were teaching classes, and specifically when you really started in television. So tell us about how you got started, how you went from teaching the classes to being on TV.
Well, first of all, when I first teach cooking class, it's only maybe in the U.S. probably about 2,000 or 3,000 chop suey chow mein restaurant. There's no upscale restaurant. There's no regional flavors. All you need is basically Americanized style Chinese food. You know, most people only know chow mein, chop suey, fried rice, and spring roll, and very basic, and not even hot and sour soup. And nowadays, you know, through all this year, you know that there are 52,000 Chinese restaurants of all kind of wonderful regional cuisines. So basically, after during the 4 or 5 years of teaching, I was actually get so used to talking to people, in front of people, I was never afraid. I never felt uncomfortable talking to people. So what happened is, one of the summer, I went back to Calgary to help a friend to open a restaurant. And my friend is a high school.
Only in the summer.
Yeah, only in the summer. I went back there, and because it's in the summer. It's no cooking class. the university town, everybody left. So I went back to help a friend to open a restaurant. And this friend studied accounting, but he wanted to bring his family there, so he had to open a restaurant in order to bring his family from Hong Kong to Canada.
Okay.
So I helped him out, and because I have some basic skills in cooking and kitchen. So I helped him out. And his restaurant is very close to television station, CFAC in Calgary. So a lot of these people actually come to the restaurant to eat. And when they come, I always tell them, hey, tell me how much you want. I'll cook you a lunch or dinner. You get me, if you want to have $20 a person, I'll cook you $20.
Mm-hmm.
So get to know some of these producer, director, and cameraman. But I never thought of doing television. And then what happened is on Friday, they have a talk show, an everyday talk show. And then each Friday, they have a chef from Intercontinental to do a little cooking segment.
Okay.
And one day on Thursday, the producer called me frantically, can you come? Can you come to the studio? Our chef got sick and we need somebody tomorrow. And I said, I don't know how to cook on television. I never faced a television. I never faced a camera before. You better ask somebody else. And say, no, you got to come because they would love your food. You got to come. So, but what happened is I was saying, okay, because you helped me out. You helped my friends. So I'll do it. But I guarantee you, I may not be very good.
Yeah.
No, don't worry. Because, so what happened is I put the stuff in my trunk, in the trunk, and it's also 30-degree minus. And then what happened is
Calgary.
I can't
Calgary.
Yeah, Calgary. I cannot even open the trunk and get my food out. Finally, the engineer they pried over my trunk and get the stuff out. And everything is frozen. And then it's only about half an hour before the show. In the old days, there's no microwave oven. You cannot even defrost the damn thing. So I told the director and the host, I said, look, you know, all this food is frozen. Even the oil is frozen. So what would you cook? So and I joked, I said, well, you know, maybe we can show them how to do frozen food. Because when I was in college, frozen food is very popular. You know, frozen dinner is very popular. I'm going to show you how to do some frozen dinner. So I used my knife to chop up some of the things and chop up the frozen vegetable and just throw it in the wok and just stir it. And I said, look, you know, I don't know about you. I love frozen dinner. So this is frozen dinner for you. So I just put it in and heat it up and just put some seasoning and let the wok melt all the stuff. And then it turned out to be a lot of water. And I said, you know what? This is frozen dinner in broth. So this is how I start my television. And then what happened?
Legendary career.
And then what happened is also timing that most television stations, if you know, that the manager or the programmer would have television, about six or seven television in the office. They want to catch their competitors and see what kind of programming this. And he normally don't watch his own station, CFAC. That day was happened. He happened to catch a little glimpse of what I'm doing. I was so crazy, running around and talking about frozen food, frozen dinner, and then say, tell the director, ask Chef Martin to come back next week. We'll give him a half an hour rather than about 20 minutes. Give him a half an hour. I said, I didn't want to go. I said, look, you know, it was a disaster. I don't want to embarrass myself, right? I said, no, come back. We love your food. Even if it's frozen dinner, we love it. So I came back and I tried to impress the host. And I said, last time it was a frozen. So this time it's not frozen. I said, I have, in half an hour in the restaurant, I can cook a lot of dishes in half an hour. I'll show you how to do three dishes in half an hour. But he was asking question and this and that and said, all you have to do is you want to talk to the audience. All you have to do is look at the camera with the red light. But they've got three cameras, right?
Mm-hmm.
The red light is jumping from one camera to another. I have no idea which camera to look at. Everything is live. And then this time, I think the general manager actually watched me. And he said, this guy is crazy. So I said, okay, ask him to come back again next week and do another one. So this one, they give me an entire hour. So this is the beginning of my career. After I finished the third time, they asked me, the director said, you know, our manager want to talk to you. So I go up there and talk to them and said, hey, Martin, how would you like to do television? I said, well, I just did three already, you know. I have never done it before, but I did three already, and I haven't really feel very comfortable because I have no idea how this red light jumping from one camera to another. So, you know what? I would like to ask you to do 130 shows.
And I said, 130?
Yeah, 130 shows. That means it's a daily show. If 130 shows is enough to broadcast daily for 6 months, they normally repeat it once. That means people would watch me all year round. And this is how I start my career from the top. I start doing hosting 130 shows. And then they said, we'll pay you $100 a show. And I said, wow, $100, that's not bad. So I finished all 130 shows by myself with a lady and an assistant cook from my kitchen. Three of us finished, we did five shows a day. We finished all 130 shows in 26 days. So I make $13,000 in 25 days, 42 years ago.
That's incredible.
So it's a lot of money. Then after that, I left and went back to UC Davis, finished my school and teaching. 3 months later, they call, Chef Yan, we've got to talk to you. Because everybody, they put a show on the air. There's a commercial station. And everybody called the station and asked for recipes. Chef Yan, do you have a cookbook? I said, no, I don't have a cookbook. You got to write a cookbook because everybody wants your recipe, but I don't have any money. How can you write a cookbook? You got to publish a cookbook. So I said, okay. I talked to all my friends and roommate and asked them to each of them give $1,000 to $3,000. I actually talked to somebody and published a cookbook myself. And I print out about 10,000 copies with all the money I get. About $40,000 from all my friends and roommate. And it sold out in 3 months. So my career is a lot of a string of unpredictable events.
I mean, yeah, this is really, I think you can probably realistically say that about most lives, but this is top shelf unpredictable events. So then let me help fast forward the story a little bit. Of course, your show started here in the States in 1982, Yan Can Cook.
But before 82, we actually did 520 shows in Canada already. Then I came back here because I only go up there to do the show in the summer. Okay. After that, so each year I go up there. Each year I go up there and they double my salary. The first year is 100. The second year, I'll say, 200. And the third year, 400. By the time I finished that, I was making quite a bit of money. Those days, that's a lot of money. In 23 days, make $50,000. That's a lot of money.
That's incredible. Okay, so now you're in the States. Yan Can Cook starts in the United States in 1982.
Yeah.
You're on public television.
Yeah, what happened is a lot of the people on PBS close to Canada, they were actually watching my show from Canada. So that's why somebody on PBS and KQED, the station knows, heard about it and say, hey, you know. So I come down here and somebody contact me and say, hey, we would like to do a show. So I start doing the show with San Francisco KQED Channel 9, PBS. I start doing the show, but we only do about 26 or 52 shows rather than 130 shows. So since 1982, I've been working with public television station in KQED in Sacramento for the last 42 years.
40 years, yeah.
Yeah, 40 years.
We're talking to one of the true greats of food television, Martin Yan. We'll be back with more with him after this break. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. We have the one, the only Martin Yan here with us today, telling us all about his improbable life in food TV. Let's get back to it with him. So tell me about this. When you said you first started cooking, you know, just for your roommates, you know, watching Julia Child, and then suddenly you're on, you're in the same league, you know, you and Julia have both have your shows on PBS. Like, how did that feel? Even at that time?
Well, first of all, I never look at that as, you know, in those days, it's not like today, you know, chefs are celebrities. In those days, we're just cooking teachers. We're cooking mm-hmm. teachers. We teach cooking class all over the country, like Jacques. We teach cooking class. Mm-hmm. Even Julia Child with Justin Wilson and all of that teach cooking class. And to us, we're just cooking teachers. We're not really celebrities. And also, public television is basically educational. Everybody wants it's a how-to show. So we never look at ourselves as a celebrity. So we just go for it. And I feel really good. And throughout the year, we work with Julia and Graham Kerr and Jacques Pepin and all these television television hosts, and to do fundraising for public television station all over the country. So we always bump into each other, and Julia Child loved Chinese food, and we always take her out to Chinese restaurant, have dim sum, because she spent some time in Kunming, Yunnan province, during the war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me ask this, though. So, you know, from the very beginning of your TV career, you know, you had, like you said, 500-some-odd episodes, and then you started your American TV career. As you said, you've been around food your whole life. Your father was your father had a restaurant. Obviously, you started in a restaurant young. But to your point, you had never been a head chef. You hadn't had a whole career as a chef in restaurants. At some point, were you feeling like, were you researching the dishes you were showing on the show? Were these dishes you already knew? Were the dishes you were inventing? Tell us about the food you were actually presenting on these shows.
Well, actually, as a chef, the most important thing is the basic skills. And then I have acquired enough basic skills in my 5 or 6 years in a restaurant. So I know how to use, I know how to cook, how to prep, mm-hmm. how to marinate, and all the seasoning, the combination. And also, actually, I missed telling you is right before I came, I actually spent about 6 months, 8 months working, teaching, learning from a master chef. Taking cooking class, because somebody actually told me, if you know how to cook, when you come to America, you can always get a job, a summertime job, or when you go to school, you can get a job. You can always get a job as a chef. I actually spent 8 months.
So that was your plan B.
Yeah, and that's plan B. I actually spent 8 months, but I don't have any money to pay for the school. So I helped him. I helped him to shop. I helped him to clean up. I helped him to, I'm the cooking, a cooking assistant for him. So I learned, a lot more from the master, from this master chef. He taught me the art of barbecue, you know, the barbecue duck, barbecue spare rib, and he taught me how to marinate, what are the traditional way of marinating. So all the basic skills that I also learned from that 8 months, even though I already have the basic skill, but I actually polished my skill under these two masters. And he's the top chef from in Hong Kong. So and then we actually kept connected. For years. Every time I go back to Hong Kong, I will go and visit him. Mm. And then throughout the years, I work in restaurant and I own my restaurant. At one point, we have 12 restaurants. And we just have one restaurant we run for 8 years. And because of the pandemic, we just recently closed it. We have the restaurant for 8 years. We're packed day in and day out, called MY China. Martin Yen's China. Basically, I basically polish and continue to learn. And throughout the year, when I teach cooking class, when I travel and do television shows, I work with all the masters. I always go in the kitchen and learn. And I never stop learning. I'm still learning. In fact, last night I went to a Vietnamese restaurant and worked with a chef, and he was recently competing with Bobby Frey. And I went to his restaurant, and I went right into this restaurant and talked to him about food. So I'm learning, practicing my craft and learning every day. Never stop learning.
I love it. Yeah, I love it. So what are some dishes that you remember in the early days that you loved showing in your classes, showing on television? What were some dishes that you remember, you know, that would really be really fun to teach?
Well, I always tell people, you know, a lot of time people in America is very, and most of them are professional. Most of my students, when I was teaching at UC Davis, most of them are actually a professional. They're either doctors or lawyers or engineers. And they want to learn something simple. So my slogan is always, if Yang can cook, so can you. So anything that I can do, you can do it. It's nothing fancy. It is very simple, very healthy. And I basically teach people how to come up with a meal, a complete meal in half an hour. If you finish, you put the rice in a rice cooker. When the rice cooker is done in 20 to 25 minutes, my meal is done. So I basically show people how to make use of all the seasonal. For the Chinese, you eat with the season. You eat with the freshest. You don't eat frozen food. You don't eat canned food. That's the reason why people go shopping, because no refrigeration in most part of the household in China those days. So I basically teach people how to cook seasonal food, seasonal ingredient, fresh ingredient. And in a true sense, this is what we should eat, farm to table, right? And and most of the stuff I can do in half an hour, but particularly stir-fried dishes. Only takes about 3 or 4 minutes to cook. You don't need to talk. And also very exciting, you can see the transformation of the color, the flavor, the aroma. You can sell other than you put something in the oven. It takes half an hour to 2 hours to do it. And it's much more fun to do stir-fry with a wok. So wok cooking is a lot of fun. And that's how I start. I start my career, and I still using my wok to do a lot of things. I even bake the pizza in a wok.
How do you make a pizza in a wok?
Yeah, it's very basic. A wok is like an oven. You know, I heat it up at medium low, so it's hot enough on the bottom, and I cover it on top. So let the dry heat to cook it. So basically, the wok turned into a oven, cooktop, a stovetop oven. You tried it. It's very fast, too.
That's incredible. I will try that. I would be very afraid of scorching the bottom of the pizza, but I'll try it.
You don't use high heat. You use medium-low heat, just enough heat on the bottom.
Okay, I will experiment, or maybe offline. You can. I'll set my phone up and be like, okay, chef, you got to help me out here. Okay, but let me ask you this, though. As you said, you've always been a student of Chinese food as well as a teacher. And, you know, I remember watching your show when I was young and, you know, I would see a lot of the dishes, that I remember eating in my home, or would literally probably eat that night for dinner, and seeing, oh my God, here this person, you know, teaching Americans how to cook this, where all my white friends in school were like, I don't know what that is you eat. You know, like, it just felt so important to me to know that someone was out there teaching, you know, the parents of my friends about the food that I was eating at home. And, you know, you've been such a wonderful ambassador and you know, introducing people to Chinese food to people who didn't know it. And then I remember seeing you at a conference, you know, 30 years later. This is a few years ago. And I think you were introducing your chef from MY China.
Yeah.
And if I'm not mistaken, he's a noodle master among his many other skills. Yeah. And he was showing us, he was demonstrating, here's how he hand pulls noodles. Here's how he makes noodles into a rope. And he like slices it super thin with a knife to create different kinds of noodles. He just did all these different techniques. And all I could think was like, this is a kind of mastery of cuisine that is so hard to find anywhere, you know, let alone this master of Chinese cuisine here in America. But, you know, you and I were chatting to get ready for this the other day, and you said that when you were growing up in China, the traditional culinary arts almost disappeared because of that period of famine.
Yep.
So talk to me about how you think we can preserve those arts today, and how, you know, is that something that Americans appreciate enough to really, you know, invest in?
Well, throughout the years, I normally tell people, you know, China is such a vast land with different topography, geography, climate factors. So each region actually produces a very distinctive regional cuisine, regional flavor profile. People always consider Chinese cooking as about four main regional cuisine, which is actually not really accurate. Then they expanded to 8 regional cuisine. Actually, China has 32 regional, very distinctive regional cooking style and a regional cuisine flavor profile and 118 different style of cooking. Because people in old days, they don't travel. So each county, each province, each city developed their own because it's available. Like in Sichuan, they have the Sichuan peppercorn. It is hot and humid. So they have a lot of chili. And they have dry chili, pickled chili, chili powder, Sichuan peppercorn. You can make a dish not only hot and spicy, different layer and different flavor profile within one dish. And sometimes one single dish, don't just use one chili. They use pickled chili, chili powder, chili oil, and Sichuan peppercorn. So it's very complex because the diversity. So basically what I try to do is, just like in the early days, you hardly see too many sushi restaurant, ramen restaurant, or Cambodian restaurant, or Myanmar restaurant. Nowadays, you see a lot of regional dishes from different parts. You can go to different places. You can have a noodle restaurant, a porridge restaurant, only specialized in porridge. And then pot sticker. You know, they serve nothing but pot sticker. So nowadays, people are more and more exposed because of the technology, because of the media, and because of the high tech. You can learn things from all over the world. Now we're learning a lot more, a lot faster. You can, let's spread the table. You introduce Indian cuisine. You introduce all kind of cuisine to people. And not, you know, the Indian cuisine, Northern India, very different than Southern India. Okay, so just like Vietnam, the pho, the noodle soup, northern in Hanoi, the noodle soup is very different than Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City. Yeah. Very, very different because of technology, because of travel. We're all world travelers. So now we got exposed to all of this a lot more than ever before. So we are very fortunate to live in a century of technology. We can learn a lot more. We can expose ourselves to a lot more things.
Yeah. It's meaningful to hear that from someone like you, who was there, you know, at the beginning of his career here when, you know, like you said, you know, you would go to a store and you can't even find soy sauce. You can't find, you know, no one has a wok. And now these things are readily available. And they're not just readily available because of technology, but because of the work of people like you to have, you know, shared the love and the passion and, you know, help expose people to these ideas and these cuisines. And, I'm really thankful for that. So thank you very much, Chef.
Well, my pleasure. All my life, you know, cooking and food is my passion and my love. And the better yet, as a cooking teacher, as a host, you know that you're sharing your craft, your passion with not thousands, but millions of people, because our show was broadcast at one point in 60 countries around the world, reaching close to 2 billion people. Because our show is in India, in southern part of China, and all over Southeast Asia, in Japan, Korea, and England, and Ireland, and Middle East, all over. So we have been very fortunate and have such wonderful culinary journey that I can share. Everywhere I travel, I get to know the chef. And they always invite me to the kitchen, and not only eating, but also a learning experience. So every day, there's a Chinese saying in Cantonese, "Zhou dou lou, hok dou lou," means when you work all your life and you learn, you never stop learning all your life.
Yeah. Pretty good from a little boy from Guangzhou.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
My pleasure.
Martin Yan Show is, of course, Yan Can Cook, which is still broadcast today. You can find episodes from its archives on YouTube. Thanks so much for listening to me get to chop it up with Uncle Martin. He's not really my uncle, it's what Chinese people call each other. But man, that was fun. We'll talk to you next week. The Splendid Table is supported by you,
thanks to everyone who supports their member station and this public radio program. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also subscribe to our weekly email, Weeknight Kitchen. It sends a recipe straight to your inbox every Wednesday, make dinner a little easier. It's at splendidtable.org. The show comes together with the help of our team, Jenny Lubke, Erica Romero, and Sally Swift. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.